already eligible.
I got you. Okay.
Representative Baumann, these payments are outside of PERS. These incentive pay programs are outside of PERS.
Right.
They're not in PERS.
Gotcha. But they want to sort of get into PERS by making you, in terms of dividing whatever the right salary is, divide by 36 to multiply it, by a point, whatever it is.
Exactly, and that's why this whole entire section is offered as an amendment to help us control that attempt to balloon the final pay.
Gotcha.
Now, yes, I'd like to go ahead for a second if I could, Mr.
Chairman.
It's currently, I guess, state employees are allowed to count 13 months of pay in the final year of covered employment to balloon with that 13th month. Isn't that correct? We might suggest that amendments could be drafted to eliminate the inclusion of that 13th month. Would PERS subscribe to that, or would you disagree with that?
Representative,
the 13th month could be, and that is used. So I guess I don't know that anybody's done any actuarial work on that particular one, but it might be something that we, at least as a member of this committee, that might suggest that the bill be amended in that to that effect.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Simpson, the question came up last night. The actuaries already billed into the state rate the payment of that 13th check, bearing in mind that if you do not wait until the end of the year, but if you retire on December 1, you can, the law says you can increase your last 3 years' salary by 5.5% for each one of those full calendar years. And in some cases, that is a greater benefit than what it is to waiting until the end of the year and receiving the 13th check. And the law was amended last session to allow the 0.5% addition for each month that you were employed during a calendar year that was not used. So, yes, the actuaries do take it into consideration, and sometimes we're finding it beneficial to the employee not to wait until the 12th month to take the 13th check, but to go through and take the retire on December 1 and improve those each of the full calendar years, those three full previous calendar years, by 5.5%.
Maybe at some time you can explain to me how that comes about. I've never heard of that. I've heard of the 13th month, or of course I wouldn't have mentioned it, but the 5.5%, I've never that. Because I guess I'm not going to retire, or as the actuarial said, some people die, and you know, I'm not planning on that either.
But when you do, plan it with your actuarial.
Yeah.
Because it may be your benefit to live a few days.
If you have time, Representative Simpson, I'd be glad to stay after the meeting and show you how that portion of the law operates.
Go ahead. Hey, I'm running out of the
I think the issue is something that ought to be pursued directly, and that is, last session, PERS brought you a bill that would make it possible for people to retire midway through a year and not be penalized by not being able to count a portion of the year. You used the three highest of the last 5 years. So if you were a school teacher, for example, and you wanted to quit at the end of the school year, you might lose any salary increase that you'd had in that 6 months. So the bill, Senate Bill 148, was passed, which gave a credit of 0.5% of your salary as an increase. So it was the average, it produced, in effect, a 6% built-in salary increase. Well, if there's no salary increase in the coming biennium for state employees, that means that the system now is going to build in on this average, a salary increase for purposes of retirement. I just raised the issue. Mm-hmm. Now, some employees may be getting salary increases, and there won't be the incentive to manipulate the system in perhaps some local governmental units. But certainly at the state level, there would be an incentive to to retire after the 11th month and get the 5% for each month.
I think one of the issues that was trying to be dealt with, the addition of the 0.5% for each additional month worked into the next year, was a primary benefit to teachers who, as everybody knows, school's out around the end of June. And to be loyal to the kids in their class, they would follow through, they would complete the school year, and then they would be left with under the previous law, they received no service credit for those last 6 months worked into the next year. And to primarily relieve those people of not being able to count that time.
That's when we'll come back to them and get the work session, that issue of the teachers, the higher education bonus. Okay, Ken, why don't you go on?
All right, the next amendment, and this is, again, is an amendment offered by higher ed that was not a part of our original bill. Payments for instructional services rendered to institutions of higher education when those services are in excess of full-time employment that were subject to PERS. And it says a person employed under a contract for less than 12 months is subject to this paragraph only for the months to which the contract pertains. Essentially, if a person is covered full-time employment and then they are hired, it may be, it's not limited to just academic people. Any person could be hired for extra work. And what they're doing with this provision is not covering that for retirement purposes. Again, that was not part of the board's original bill when it was submitted. I believe that would the effect of that, Jerry, correct me if I'm wrong, that would be a cost saver to the employer and not having to cover that time for pension purposes.
Mr. Chairman, what this really is, I talked to Bill Lemon today on the telephone, is that a faculty member, say who's on a 9 month contract, sometimes will do some extra work, do a short course or a seminar, and get a contract or a payment for doing that. And what this particular provision would do would be to exempt that extra contract from their having to make PERS payments on it. So it would reduce their cost for those contracts. And of course, the way they've approached it is to put that into this section, which says these things are excluded for purposes of calculating salary. The last sentence in this amendment says that if they do a contract during the summer, when they're not under their 9 months teaching contract, then it would count for purposes of salary and that would pay the PERS payment on it.
Okay.
That's what its intention is.
Okay. The next amendment in order of appearance is the change in the definition of parole probation.
Ken, let's retract a little bit here. I don't particularly care if the amendments to the original bill. Can you just run us through the bill fairly quickly and tell us what the major elements are?
Okay. The next item that appears is the change in definition of parole probation officers. And again, that would allow those people who were transferred to county employment to continue with the police and fire classification.
It's a higher classification.
A higher class. They would receive the 2% formula in retirement instead of the 1.67.
Okay.
That they once enjoyed that, and when their employment was transferred, they lost that.
You're recommending that change?
Yes. That's put forth by the board, and that is the piece that carries the small cost. The next amendment adds a word consecutive to a certain 30-day working limitation period when work is interrupted. Jerry, would you comment?
At the present time, the law states that to establish membership, you must be employed for 6 months uninterrupted by 30 working days. now that there are people on four-day work weeks, we're finding that there is a 30-day break in that six-month period. So by putting the word consecutive, these employees who work four-day, 10-hour days would establish membership after 6 months.
Okay. There is an amendment here, and I'm not sure if the amendment has been taken out. We originally had language on page 5 of the bill, and that is really the subject of Senate Bill 368, so we would request that that be removed if that has not been been done already. This was just another way to deal with the issue raised in Senate Bill 368. On page 8, lines 20 and 21, these amendments create the obligation to return not only withdrawn contributions upon return to employment within the statutory five-year period, but also interest would have to be accumulated during the period separated. Since we've gone to the full formula system, it's necessary that the member pay their contributions back with interest to adequately fund that benefit. And this simply is requiring the employee to pay back withdrawn contributions with interest.
What interest rate is used?
Whatever we're paying at the time.
Does it say that?
No, it does not. I think just whatever we're crediting here.
No, I think whatever interest we paid during that period of time that they held the money.
Okay, just the performance of the fund.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. On that same page, line 8, the next amendment would prevent a member from retiring, withdrawing a lump sum distribution with a 1% employer pension, and then upon reemployment, applying for a full formula benefit. This is to keep it whole and avoid an anti-selection that could otherwise take place. Would you comment, Jerry?
This amendment would stop the practice that of myself retiring now, taking a lump sum payment, then after 6 months coming back in the payroll for a couple of months and retiring again, and then saying I'll take the full 167 and I won't take a refund of my account balance, which then is only, you know, $500. That way, because what I'd end up doing then is I'd end up getting the 167 full formula plus the lump sum refund of my money.
This offers protection to the trust. Okay. So
that I'm sorry, when you were saying amendments before and I made my statement, I thought you were talking about amendments to the law, not the amendments by the committee.
I'm sorry, yes.
As long as we're disclosing the general
text of the bill. On page 9, the change that appears there on line 21 and to 23, this maintains the validity of a previously filed designation of beneficiary unless the member changed the designation in writing, regardless of refunds or withdrawals. What can happen now, a member will withdraw and return and fail to possibly designate a new beneficiary, and it leaves some doubt as to who the beneficiary of record should be. This allows us to pay whoever was listed last, and adds clarity. On that same page, page 9, and then on page 10, this language would clear the distribution of employee accounts upon death. It would designate payment where there is no designated beneficiary, directing payment to the estate if probated, then to the next of kin if no probate. Technical correction. At the very bottom of page 10, line 39, and then appearing on page 11, this would clarify and speed up the distribution of benefits to survivors of deceased members in both probated and non-probated estates to prevent the payment of both a death benefit and a survivor option available to a retired or disabled member within 120 days after terminating service. As I understand this, the language is not clear, and apparently people have expected both payments. Is that correct, Jerry?
That is correct.
Okay. So this would make it clear that that you can't have both, depending on the circumstance. They would either continue with the survivor option or the lump sum death benefit. And the last item on page 13 will place the individual active and retired employee records in an exemption from disclosure status, along with the majority of agency personnel information, this disclosure of which should be considered privileged and highly private and personal. I understand that there was a ruling of the court, and I'm not certain if it was Court of Appeals in March, that ruled that the home address of teachers employed on a temporary basis is now public, which I guess raises a question here, because we have never disclosed home addresses for any purpose. And now apparently the court has changed that, according to our legal counsel, and I haven't had an opportunity to pursue that. Apparently there's a requirement now to survey your employees and ask them if they want their address released or not. But anyway, it would be our intention to simply to clarify that the retirement folder, the personal information, would not be considered public. And that's the entire bill, Mr. Chairman.
Except for the additions of the committee.
Exactly.
Right. Mr.
Chairman.
Yes, Max.
Under the 114, we're talking about just state employees. Here we're talking about all local entities. What does this do to local fire department personnel and the sheriffs and local police and small of cities?
Okay. All of the provisions that are contained in the bill would apply equally to state employees, fire departments, school districts, uniformly to all employees in the plan.
The amendments then, the bulk of the amendments adopted by the banking committee, then just repeat the bulk of this measure and apply it to the teachers' retirement fund, is that correct?
Yeah, I believe there were conforming amendments to TRFA.
Chairman, I think that happens on every bill that is passed. It's PERS, the companion legislation is usually passed for TRFA.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead then with Thomas Kramer and get that in place.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Kramer. I'm representing Teachers Retirement Fund Association. And to answer your question, Representative Bauman, you're absolutely right. The bulk of the amendments apply the provisions of the bill affecting PERS to the Teachers Retirement System. And as Jerry pointed out, that's traditional for bills affecting PERS.
If this great merger takes place, are we going to be just dumping all kinds of statutes out of existence?
Right. That's right. These amendments cover the period in between now and the merger, just as the prior conforming amendments have done for the period since they were passed in the merger. But this whole process of passing conforming amendments will be obviated by the merger.
Okay.
Other than the conforming amendments which the committee has, applying the bill to the teachers' retirement system as it applies to PERS, I wanted to present to the committee a letter which we submitted to Senator Cohen on June 6th and explained in a letter dated June 10th to Senator Ripper and Representative Katz. It was a substantive effect of the bill, of one part of Section 1 of the bill affecting definitions of salary, which we thought presented some problems, and we presented the problem in a simple way of dealing with it to the committee. Senate Commerce Committee preferred not to address those problems but to pass the bill out, the due pass recommendation, and send them on to your committee with those points to be considered. I'd be happy to answer any questions about those points for the committee. Otherwise, I'll let the letter stand for itself.
The open issues in this bill, the question of the higher education thing, the section that was requested be handled in Senate Bill 368. Those don't affect you at all?
That's correct.
Okay. The amendment you talk about in the letter to Senator Cohen is only clarifying?
We think it's only clarifying. We're not sure how the bill would be interpreted. And we're not sure, in fact, what was intended by the bill, whether the bill intended something different from that. I would interpret the bill consistent with the amendment, and so I would interpret the amendment as being only clarifying, but I couldn't swear to that.
Okay, we'll check that with you. Any other comments? Great. Any other questions, Tom?
Well, I guess, Mr. Chairman, I might. I'm reading from the letter addressed to Senator Cohen, the paragraph.
Yes, sir.
Payment for accumulated unused sick leave and any retirement service pay is not salary for purpose of calculating retirement benefit.
According to the bill, that's correct, sir.
And but that is used in every other calculation as far as the PERS is concerned. It is not.
Chairman, I might want to clarify that. Representative Simpson, a payment for sick leave is not used to increase final average salary. The sick leave is paid. If they make a lump sum payment for it, we do not use that in final average salary.
You've been there for some time. Did you ever do that?
No, sir.
Never.
Now, okay. We do use the unused portion to increase final average salary, but if it's a payment in full, then we do not use it. We only use credit for one half of it.
It says accumulated unused. I guess your terminology is difficult to understand for a lay person. But, Kayla, are you going to?
No, Jerry said, we now allow credit onto the final average salary of one half of the monetary value of the sick leave that you don't use during your career. That's aside from the issue of payment of sick leave.
So if you retire and you have $500 of sick leave coming, that's just a little bonus added into your last 3 years, half of that?
Value half.
Let's take, if you were a teacher, a little easier way to explain it to them. And you had accumulated over the, you get 10 days a year, that's given to you. If you don't use them, and you accumulated 200 days, that's equivalent to 1 year's salary. But you would only get credit for one half of it. So if your salary was $30,000 a year by that time, then when you compute the last 3 years' salary, you say you have $30,000 each year, that'd be $90,000, and you give them credit for their sick leave for one half of that, so it'd be $15,000. And then you divide that by three, so it steps your
that's
average salary at the end.
That's current law.
Well, yes.
That's current law.
Sure.
Well, for state employees and schools, it's optional.
Yeah. And well, I discovered one thing there: you have to ask the right questions.
Yeah.
Or you don't get the explanation that you're looking for. And I think that's too bad. I may not know the right question.
Well, Representative Simpson,
but then it leaves doubts in my mind as to just exactly what we're talking about. And I make no pretense to understand this totally. And sometimes you leave me very, very cold, and I don't like that. I don't like that.
Some cities and counties now, if you had 1,000 hours of sick leave, would pay you off for those 1,000 hours of sick leave. Now, we would not include that money in final average salary, and there would be no calculation of unused final average salary. And those are the two differences. Those people who get paid off in cash do not gain anything on their retirement. So this is to avoid a double benefit. down there.
I might add just on one note to cloud the issue a little for you, Jerry. Jerry's points are, of course, conditioned upon PERS knowing that amount is included in there. Apparently, school district number one for some time has been lumping the amount in and not identifying it. And so PERS, despite its administrative rule, as well as the teacher's retirement system, has been calculating final average pay with that amount included, because PERS, like the teacher's retirement system, has no way of differentiating it out.
Any other questions at this time? Okay, thank you. Kirk, would you? Kirk's going to raise the issue of the parole and probation officers, correct?
Right.
Would you rather wait and get the whole committee as we go into work session, as opposed to just the House act?
It's your pleasure.
Does that make more sense for you?
Sure.
I think it makes. You're going to have to repeat it anyway.
Let me make one comment related to it. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kirk Berger, representing the Association of Oregon Counties and League of Oregon Cities. Related to an earlier issue about final average salaries, let me throw it out for people to think about. The last session in Senate Bill 148, which resulted in this 0.5% add-on if you don't work the full calendar year, one of the options was simply to use the final 36 months, which might seem to make the most sense. The reason it didn't earlier, and may still not, is that it was administratively unworkable because the system gathers payroll data on a calendar year basis, so you need to use calendar years. But it's my understanding, through some additional automation of their system, that it may be possible now to look at that option again and get to the final true 36 months and not have to use all these little half percent.
We will, when we come back to that one, work session.
But sure, on the other issue, I'll be glad to wait.
I think that's probably better for everybody. Thanks. Okay, let's close on 137 and go to
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Would PERS have a comment as to just a quick comment as to in response to the 36 months that was just suggested? Yes or no, up or down?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simpson, this is an old issue. If we went to that type of a collection of data, it would force the cities and the counties to keep two sets of books. We used to be on that system up until 1956. Basically, we were on a fiscal year. Then when Social Security books are kept for Social Security, for income taxes, state taxes, federal taxes, all on a calendar year basis, we went to the calendar year basis to ensure that the districts would only keep one set of books. We would not, and we get one report a year. The other way, we would be required to get 12 reports a year of 114,000 people, and when you're on a manual system, maybe even if we were fully automated, I doubt very much. When I came to work for the board in 1950, they were on a quarterly basis, and they were about six quarters behind at that time when the membership was only about 37,000 people. Now that's 114,000. And to force the cities and counties to keep two sets of books, I think would be more of a hardship on the cities and counties and the schools and the state, too.
I think that's maybe an overstatement of that, what's actually required, isn't it? Isn't the point Kirk made that now with some of the automated stuff, you can break out partial years? It's going to be entered on a monthly basis anyway?
No, we would not go to a monthly basis. There'd be no reason to for us to, unless it was for this particular reason. We would gain nothing by going to it and post accounts, post 114,000 accounts every month. There'd be nothing to gain from it.
You wouldn't gain anything. Who would gain or lose other than the keeping two sets of books? I guess we have to call an actuary.
Yeah. Who would gain? I don't think anybody would gain, except that there'd be more jobs out there, I'm sure, in the cities and counties, and that those people would be keeping the sets of books. But there'd be, it would not change anybody's benefits whatsoever.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Great. The board, I think, is probably has accepted, I hope.
Representative
McCoy?
No.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Representative Jones? Representative Simpson?
Aye.
And Chair, Representative Bowman?
I don't want to vote.
Aye.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Senate Bill 170 is passed with Bill Cady. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, take an ordinary moment here to speak about House Bill 2366. That is the judge's retirement bill. Governor Attia supports the concept of an adequate retirement system for judges. There is virtually an identical bill introduced in the Senate as well. This one has moved through House Judiciary already, but I want to make sure the members of the committee knows that while there is no money in the governor's budget, it's part of the judicial branch. Hopefully something will be worked out, and you'll be getting very explicit testimony on the problem with the judge's retirement system. If you don't already know that, we're late.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let's move on now to Senate Bill 368, Senator Ryles. Before we start, Kay will take about 1 minute just to give a general overview and relate it to some other legislation we made.